Welcome to the Project Zion podcast. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts Community of Christ offers for today's world.
Hello, this is Robin Linkart with Project Zion podcast. We're so glad to have all of you with us again today. Today we are going to talk about mission in our series called What's Brewing. Today we have Blake Smith with us from Chicago Mission Center. He lives in Carpentersville, Illinois. Blake serves as the Mission Center President and Financial Officer in the Chicago Mission Center, and he holds the office of 70, and we are really glad to have him with us today. Thank you for being with us, Blake.
Well, thanks, Robin. I really appreciate the invitation.
Blake, we are interested to hear about you as we get started on this story. So can you tell us a little bit about where you grew up, what it was like to grow up in the church, and how did your life as an ordained minister begin?
Well, I was born and raised in Pensacola, Florida, very heavily influenced Southern Baptist area in the country and in the church. The reason I say that is because there was a sense that I needed to keep quiet about what church I went to. My friends, there was immediate persecution, if you will, from even my friends. One of my really good friends' father was the lead pastor at the main Baptist church down the street that spoke from the pulpit about us being non-Christian. And so, you know, that was kind of in there. But also from the side of where I was in Pensacola, it was a very conservative, traditional area of the church. For instance, I was probably 21 before I remember studying biblical passages. Every class, even through young adulthood, we studied the Book of Mormon. And I remember asking later in after having left the area and come back and just talking about with some of the people who had been my teachers and with my parents as well, that, you know, why was that? I mean, I didn't even realize it was just so much of who we were that I didn't realize what I wasn't studying until I met someone who was raised in a Bible-only church, and I was around people who were telling stories, and I would just have to pretend like I knew what they were talking about. But part of that was this deep understanding that at a point in our life, we would have to teach other people the Book of Mormon, that every Christian would know the Bible, but we would have to know the Book of Mormon. And so, that just to give you an idea, that's kind of the environment that I came out of. My family was always in church. I mean, if the doors were open, we were there. Work days, prayer service, Sunday mornings, witnessing weekends, everything. My father, who was a convert to the church, served in a lot of leadership roles. He was pastor for many years. He served as a district president for a group of churches in the Pensacola area. So he was always, I mean, that was a very big part of who we were. And I was kind of an unusual child in that I loved to go to prayer service. I loved to go to prayer service. I mean, I would be out playing and on a Wednesday afternoon after school, and I could be ready in 5 minutes to go to church. I mean, because I did not want to miss that. I enjoyed being with the people and hearing their stories and listening to their prayers repeated week after week. But it was that community. I mean, that was where I really felt community. So, I mean, those were informing in terms of being raised and being a part of the church. It just was a deeply integrated part of who we were.
Alrighty. So you grew up in Pensacola, Florida. So tell us a little bit about your college years, and then when were you actually ordained to ministry during that period of time? Because I'm not really clear on what age you were and under what circumstances your first call came.
Well, I was actually, because I was so involved in the church, I mean, as early as 15 and 16, I sensed a call. People were telling me, you are going to be a minister in the church and you're going to be called. I looked at appointees who came through the area and the witnessing weekends and all of that. And I just, I felt like that was what God was calling me to do. And during that time, when I was a good church boy, nothing nothing took place. I mean, there was no call. There really weren't any younger individuals called to the priesthood in my area at that time. And so I began to, I really, quite honestly, began to wander a little bit. I mean, church has always been important. I've always been a part, but I wasn't always making the best choices. Through late high school and college, I went through 2 years of college and then traveled for a year in a group called Up With People. That's where I met the woman who is my wife, who had a very strong Christian background and began to bring that back to life in me. It was in 1989, and I was I would have been 25 years old when I was called to the office of priest. And interestingly enough, it was at a time where, I mean, I was just newly married. So when I was called, we'd only been married for just a brief period. And I didn't feel the call anymore. It's hard to explain, but I just, I mean, church was a part of my life. But I had, it was kind of like I had moved on to other things. So when the call came, I was very surprised. And it was my wife who said, you know, maybe you're not at the place you need to be in the priesthood, but God can call you because God knows what God has created you for. And that was a big point for me. And so I accepted the call to priest. It was ordained in 1989. And I was a priest for about 5 years and then was called to elder. I went to work for the church as a youth minister. So I had applied in 1990 for appointment. I get that. It was a very quick turnaround after ordained. I was like, okay, you know, I want to, I feel the call again and I'm going to, I want to be an appointee. And
so let's pause for just a minute because some of our listeners don't know what an appointee is. So just take a minute to help brief us. In fact, I think my kids probably don't know what an appointee is and they grew up in the church and their brothers worked for the church for 20 years. So
good point. I try to remember those kinds of things. So an appointee, at least early in the church in my growing up, is someone who was a full-time minister in the Reorganized Latter-day Saints Church and then the Community of Christ, employed by the church and appointed to work in various areas of the church. So their appointment might be to this geographical area for a certain period, and then they were appointed to another area. Basically, in looking back, it's a position that gives the church permission to put you wherever they need you at the time. But that was, so a full-time employee working for the church, being a full-time minister, that's when I began to feel that call again. Ironically, my mentor at the time, my priesthood mentor at the time, was a 70, who, when he heard that I was applying for full-time employment with the church, took me to lunch and said, why?
So this was when you applied to be an appointee?
When I applied to be an appointee. I applied in 1990 to be an appointee and was turned down. Not wholeheartedly, but I was just told that I needed to get some more pastoral experience and that kind of thing, and which made all the sense in the world. But then my mentor asked the question, why do you want to be an appointee? And I said, well, because I feel called to ministry. And he said to me, well, then go and be a pastor or go and be a youth minister. His analogy at that time was there was a time when the appointee force was the army, but now they were the Pentagon. So and that's a harsher analogy, I think, than he might even use at this time. But the idea was front lines working, doing ministry versus being caught in the administrative responsibilities and not being able to be with the people in a way that he was sensing I was feeling called to do. So I began a 3-year journey of praying and thinking about that. And in 1993, I went to work for the church in Independence, Missouri, as a youth minister for what was Santa Fe Stake at the time and is part of the Central Mission now.
You applied for a ministry position. Was that an appointee position when you went to work as a youth minister, or was that like a contract employee minister for a specific area, Santa Fe district?
That was a contract employee. I was hired to be a youth minister by that jurisdiction.
And Santa Fe Stake is in what we now would call Central Mission, or that Mission Center, or is it more where Far West or Midlands?
It's part of the Central Mission. Okay. So when we first went to Mission Centers, it was one of the three stakes that came together for the Tri-Stake Mission Center. Santa Fe Stake would be parts of Independence, mm-hmm. and Raytown and some of the suburbs south of the Independence area.
That is very helpful. So tell us about the various assignments in the church that you have accepted, and how you and the people you serve have engaged in mission in different ways and in different places. And I know this is going to cover quite a few years because you have been in full-time service ministry, employed ministry with the church for 29 years. 25, okay.
25. Seems like 29 some
days. Seems like 29.
No, but 25 years. So I spent 5 years as a youth minister. Interestingly enough, I had followed someone else who had been the youth minister, actually a number of people who had gone from youth minister in those central stakes to appointment. And so there was really some hesitance on the part of the people of that area wondering, how long will you be here? Are you just using this as a stepping stone to appointment or full-time ministry with the church? And quite honestly, at that point, that was not my intention. I felt called to be a youth minister. I loved what I was doing. At the end of 5 years, when I was actually asked to go and be a part of the headquarters staff and do training for youth ministry across the church, I went back to some of those people and essentially asked their permission, but basically just to say, have I fulfilled what I promised to fulfill? I don't want you to think that I came into this for this purpose. And they assented. Mm-hmm. It's okay. Mm-hmm. You have done what you promised to do. So from that point, I went, and for a very short period, I worked at headquarters. So that was in, would have been 1998. I went to work for headquarters. I did a number of training sessions, and then I was approached and asked to consider going to Graceland as the campus minister. So that would be my first appointee assignment. So I went through the appointment process. I went through the application and the interviews and all of that. And my first assignment in 1999 was to Graceland University, or Graceland College at the time. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I spent 5 years there as the campus minister.
So that was a really big change in your ministry focus in some regards, and in others, you're kind of building on what you've already been doing.
It really was. I mean, I had students who were in my youth ministry who are now students at Graceland. It was like we kind of had this joke that I was following them, but it was a natural step because and even to the day, I have a real heart for youth and young adults and just that part of the journey of life, I think probably because of my own journey through that time. So it was just a natural fit. And I would say, with the possibility of offending someone, that has been my favorite appointment. Mm-hmm. Because it just felt like such a fit. Mm-hmm. So I find ways now to be with young adults and youth and do that, and hopefully have had some positive impact. But in terms of favorite appointment, I think that will always be my favorite. I was there for 5 years, almost to the day.
Wow.
I moved in June 1st and moved out June 1st 5 years later.
Wow.
And went to what is called the Eastern Great Lakes Mission Center, which covers Cleveland along the Great Lakes, Erie, from Cleveland to Buffalo, out to Rochester, and then dips down and picks up Pittsburgh area in Pennsylvania. So it's Ohio, Pennsylvania, and New York. And I was there for 10 years. About 8 of those years, I was the Mission Center president. And then our field began to really get on this track of missional transformation. So mm-hmm. under the leadership of our apostle at the time, who was Ron Harmon, we began to experiment with some new expressions of doing ministry. So some of the administrative appointees were freed to do things more in line with their sense of call and direct ministry. So in that arrangement, I relinquished the position of Mission Center president to someone else and was freed to go and begin a church plant on the west side of Cleveland. We entered that endeavor with no preconceived notions. And I think that is really where I began. I mean, I'd had encounters with mission, as I understand mission now, but that's where it really came to life, because mm-hmm. I was working on the streets of a suburb just west of Cleveland, and I was working with underprivileged and underemployed, and we didn't have a church. We didn't have a plan. I was hanging out in diners and coffee shops, meeting people, listening to their stories, and forming small groups of people around that community. I remember the day that I was approached by a guy who asked me if I was Pastor Blake, and I said yes. And I knew who he was by reputation. And his response to the look on my face was, "Don't worry, I'm not carrying today."
Wow.
And after a deep swallow, and we became good friends. Mm-hmm. He had been a former drug dealer, but had been watching me from afar and just engaging. There was a real skepticism toward the Christian missionary, you know, mm-hmm. kind of thing mm-hmm. coming in to save the world. So it was in those experiences in Lakewood that I think I really began to understand mission in a different way.
And so how long were you there doing that particular on the ground missional ministry, so to speak?
So I was involved in that just a little over 2 years. And we were at a point actually where I approached my supervising apostle at that time and said, We're at a point where we need to make a decision. We either need to get a storefront or pull out, mm-hmm. because it had been successful in that I was meeting with people, but because of the economic conditions of a lot of the people that I was working with, they either didn't have a steady residence, uh-huh. so they were moving constantly. They might be sleeping on this friend's couch this night, and then so they didn't have a home to invite people in to have a home church, or if they did, they might have been embarrassed to have others mm-hmm. in their home. Mm-hmm. So we needed a place where we could begin to gather. Unfortunately, at that time, we were beginning to go through some changes. That experiment that we had started with missional transformation a couple years before was working in some places and not in others. And at that point, I was asked to consider a move to Chicago.
Okay.
And so very reluctantly, that was very hard for me. I spent a little time before moving, and even after beginning my work in Chicago, trying to connect those people that I had built relationships with other faith communities. Mm-hmm. The reality was a lot of the folks that I had didn't have transportation and couldn't make it to the nearest community of Christ church, which was 45 minutes to an hour away, and they didn't have a formal community, and there was no other minister engaged in that endeavor at the time. And so, but I didn't want to just leave them hanging. I wanted them to find community mm-hmm. to keep them moving in the right direction. So it did that. But then I was assigned to Chicago. I actually commuted from Cleveland to Chicago for 1 year.
Wow.
Because I had a daughter in high school, and we were committed to not having her move. But after about 9 months of commuting, she actually approached my wife and said, you know, it wouldn't devastate my childhood if we moved. And so we made a choice. She didn't like the fact that I was gone 5 days a week. And mm-hmm. So we made a choice as a family to go ahead and move. And she sacrificed and moved to Chicago and finished her junior and senior year in a new school. And I was able to commit just a full effort to Chicago. So I started commuting in 2013 and moved in 2014 officially. And then over time, I started as the financial officer. I moved into the area, which was also an interesting thing. I think there was some hesitation on the apostles' part because they knew that I was a 70. And even the president of 70 said, "You're going to do what? go in and be a financial officer." But part of that was to come in and begin building relationships and be prepared to do whatever was needed in the future. So within a couple of years, I took on the role of Mission Center president and financial officer, and have continued in that capacity and put on a few other hats in the meantime. So,
yeah. So you serve an area that, in comparison to some other Community of Christ mission centers, the geography may not be that large, but the dense population resident in this mission center and just the tangle of traffic that can make drive times very long for short distance really necessitates having someone here full-time that can support the ministries across the Chicago Mission Center. So it sounds to me, Blake, like you have experienced lots of diverse communities of Christ, that you have a long heritage in the church, grew up in the RLDS church, which yes. is one and the same of as Community of Christ, just a change in name, but definitely you have seen a lot of change over the course of your life in the church and how we understand mission and live out mission. So as you reflect on that journey, are there some common principles of mission that you can look back from this juncture and identify across the last 25, 30 years of your life of mission and ministry?
Yeah, I think that one common principle that has always been there, though has changed focus for me, is an outward focus. I mean, that has always been there. I would also say that encounter with God is something that's always been there, though I would not have identified that as a principle of mission early on. I think mission for me as a child was going on a mission trip to a developing nation and, you know, building a hut or digging a well or feeding children or that kind of thing. It was a very, maybe geographically from where I was, that was what the churches did. They hired missionaries or they supported missionaries and sent them out. It was very much a, quite honestly, a white male missionary going out to proselytize and bring hope and life to other places that didn't have what we had. So you could either write a check, your missional work was to write a check to support the missionary or to be perhaps a missionary. And that was the predominant view of mission. But now, looking back, I can say that even in those being a part of missional work was about God moving in our lives and what we were feeling, that how we could participate. Now, by the time I became a youth minister, it hadn't really changed significantly. I mean, I was still, as a youth minister, creating mission trips and collaborating with outside traditions because we didn't really have many opportunities in the church that existed where you could say, okay, we have a mission trip camp here, if you go to here. So we did some of that, but it was still about going and helping someone else, give them something that we have. Then in that youth ministry journey, I also began to journey in seminary because it was a couple of years into youth ministry where I realized that my lack of a personal journey with God. And I'll explain that a little bit. When I, growing up, and I don't know if it was the South or what it was, but it really was a situation where you believe what your mama believes and your daddy believes. And, you know, and I'll speak my Southern, what my grandmother believed and what my granddaddy believed. You know, that's just what you did. When I met Ellen, who is my wife, and she began to ask me questions about, why do you believe that? Tell me more. And I didn't have answers. My answers were because my mom believed and told me that's what we believe. So I began a journey. But in that journey, I realized how much more I needed to know to even be able to answer those questions. And so I began to go to seminary and try to learn. Had I not done that at that time in my life, what would come in the next few years of ministry, I would have been just completely blown out of the water. For instance, as a campus minister at Graceland during the 9/11 attacks. Mm. And so being in an international community, because we had students, you know, from all over the world, and the questions that were being asked and the responses that were being given by some faith traditions. And so it was just, if I had not begun that journey, I would have been lost. And so through that, I began also to really be introduced and to encounter social justice issues, questions and critical thinking that I had not really been encouraged to ask or engage in over those years. And so it was a frightening experience in some ways to go, I don't think like that. I can't do that, to realizing that I could, and I already was. I just couldn't put a name on it. But realizing that I could not go without asking those questions. I remember going to a professor. We had to write a paper basically reflecting on a text that we had been given to read. Well, I didn't agree with anything this particular author had written. But in the world I grew up in, if it was published, it was authority. Mm-hmm. I mean, why would you publish something that wasn't true, right? So I didn't have the right to disagree. And I went in anguish to my professor and said, I don't know how to write a positive paper about this because I don't agree with anything this author says. And she says to me, good. That's why we had you read that book. And that was, again, a huge eye-opener too. You mean I don't have to, I mean, I can ask these questions, I can push back. And so through that process, I began to get a different understanding of the world and mission, and that it was okay to push back and to challenge, and that it wasn't okay to respond and do things and leave people on the margins and that kind of thing. And so it was a huge permission-giving thing. But I was still on the journey of understanding what mission was. And it probably wasn't until that Lakewood, the western suburb of Cleveland, working on the streets and being day in and day out engaged in mission, personally building relationships, the importance of relationships, of making people understand that they belong before they have to believe, was huge. I mean, I was asking people, why? Tell me a little bit about your journey. Why have you not been engaged with a faith community? What would be, well, either I would get answers like, well, I don't fit in, I don't wear the right clothes, I don't think the right things, I smoke or I drink or I, you know, and I don't fit in that. The other end being, well, I don't want to be a part of that hypocrisy. Mm-hmm. Because those people are saying, don't do this, don't do that, but then I see them doing those things and I don't want to be a part of that. So it was kind of this combination, but only through the journey of relationship building was I able to hear those things, which continued to build on my understanding of mission and the importance of acceptance. I've kind of come to a place in my life, and I tell people this when I'm having conversations with folks who disagree or are struggling with inclusiveness, to say, you know, as I study and read and learn about the ministry of Christ, for me, it's all about love. And so I don't know what the afterlife will be. I don't know, you know, what it'll be. But if I were to stand before God, and I would much rather God say, Blake, you loved a little too much. You could have backed off a little bit, rather than God saying, how come you didn't love this person? Or how come you had an opportunity and you didn't do it? So I don't know about the rights and wrongs of all life behaviors. I know that we're all on a journey together, and only through that journey and that missional focus of being in relationship, encountering God, not only just in my own private relationship with God, but encountering God through others. Mm-hmm. And putting God at the forefront. So one of the things I think changed for me in the understanding of mission is I'll just speak for myself. In the past, it was, well, here's what I would like to do. God, will you bless that? You know, we're going to do this great thing. And that comes out of that mentality of we've got something we can give to somebody else to fix or to provide what they don't have. Whereas now, my focus and for a number of years has been, God, what are you doing and how can I be a part of it? And then when those opportunities open, sitting and listening to the people and hearing their story and their context. And, you know, it's kind of like Outreach International has been doing this participatory human development for years. And that's exactly what I think we need to do in mission is just journey with folks and not try to come in and say we have the fix, but God, what is God doing in your life? How can we be a part of it? You know, when I sit in front, and we've got a current ministry in Chicago called The Table, and it began out of a pastor, a young adult pastor, really struggling with pastoring an existing congregation, aging, set in their ways, happy to come on Sunday morning, sit for an hour, and then go home. And it just was eating him alive. It was sucking the life out of him. And so we began a 2-year journey together, meeting every week and praying together and talking about that. And out of that came this idea for The Table. Mm-hmm. We were meeting every week at a coffee house. So why don't we start something up here and invite other people to be a part of the conversation and see where that goes? The reality is that now, actually 4 years down the road from the beginning of that conversation between the pastor and I, The Table has changed, and it is changing the congregation. So I've always wondered, for instance, can you revitalize an existing congregation? Can you bring them to life? I think you can, but my experience, and this is a great example of it, is we don't change it from the inside. Mm. So the reality is we did this table, and the people of the table, which about 90% are folks that were engaged in no church at all, have found a loving community that is engaged in action and mission, more so now than we were even 6 months ago. But they loved being together so much that they now have infiltrated the congregation. They are attending on Sunday morning, right, so they can have more time together. And that in itself is changing the culture of the congregation.
So tell us a little bit more about The Table, because my understanding is you've had some exciting developments just in the last month or two.
Yes. So it started off really well. We were really excited in the beginning when we began this in the coffee house. We had people that were liking it and inviting others. And then about a year and a half in, we hit a plateau. It was just that it was the same people, and it was, if nothing else comes up, I'll be there, or that kind of thing. And we were back at a point, the pastor and I, saying, okay, have we run our course? Is The Table what God's calling us to at this point? And so I said, you know, let's take a couple of weeks and let's just pray about this. Let's spend some time. Let's pray with the people. Let's let them in. Let's all do this together. And let's ask God, what are you calling us to? Have we kind of naturally turned into just another congregation that enjoys being together and we get together for our hour and then we go home? Or what did you call us to in the beginning, and are we doing that? So a week later, we had a conversation with the folks who were attending The Table. And out of that conversation, we first encouraged everyone to go home and spend a week and pray and watch and listen and observe what was going on around them. Where is God active? We talked about a few possible things like a food pantry or things that we might do. We had experimented with a variety of things over the year. So we left that at that point. Well, it turns out that a couple of the members went home. They began to pray about it. And the next week, one of our members came with a pantry built and ready to be installed. So what we're doing is called a little free pantry. And we joke and put quotes around little because the average little free pantry that exists, and just quickly what that is it's outside the building. It's accessible 24 hours, 7 days a week. We have not opened it yet, but we will put pantry items, so non-perishable foods, hygiene items, things that persons might not have availability, and they can come at any time and take what they need out of the pantry. And others, if they are so inclined or called, can contribute to the pantry, bring and leave things in the pantry. It's kind of modeled after a thing called
Little Free Library.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So we decided we'll do this. Well, the average, if anybody is familiar with the Little Free Library or even the pantries, they're typically just a foot and a half to 2 foot wide, maybe 2 to 3 feet tall, mm-hmm. relatively small. Well, this member got so excited, he brought us a pantry that is 4 feet wide and 6 feet tall.
Wow.
It has three shelves. So the plan is that we'll have one shelf for non-perishable food items, one shelf for personal hygiene items, and one shelf for clothing.
Ah.
It's kind of a big thing. Out of that conversation, then we began to, this individual also went out and began to tell people in the community about it. And the community has responded, and the church basement began to fill with food long before we'd even decided exactly when and how and all of this. So we decided we had enough food, and we also knew that there was a need in schools, and we know that there are other congregations who do kind of a weekend backpack feeding program. So mm-hmm. we thought, well, why don't we do that too? The Highland, Indiana school district has a lot of poverty. So we thought, well, let's look into that. And those conversations then led to, in the spring, we could do a community garden. We have some space on the church property that we can put in a community garden and provide fresh produce to the pantry and perhaps even in the packs that we send home. And from there, it is just been one thing after another. So just a couple of quick testimonies mm-hmm, that come out of mm-hmm. out of that are just so exciting is this young man who got excited and built the pantry. He found a surplus store that was going out of business and that had all kinds of things, but it had a lot of food. He was there, and at this point, because they were selling out, the cases were $5 a case for these prepackaged meals. And so he bought 40 of them at $5 a piece. And someone saw him filling his truck and said, "What are you buying all this food for?" And he began to tell him a little bit about the table. And as soon as the person heard that it was a church, he was turned off. He didn't want anything to do with it. He said, and he kind of walked away. Long story short, Chris talked to the owner. Our member talked to the owner and said, "If you have stuff left over, let me know. We might come and get some more." The owner said that they were going to have an auction, and then if anything was left after the auction would be available for $1 a case.
Wow.
So our guy gave him his information and said, "Call me when the auction takes place, and then we'll be here." So the owner called him a week later, said the auction had taken place, and there was food left. He could come get it. When he arrived back at the surplus store, this gentleman who had asked him why he was buying the food was already there, had already paid for all of the remaining food, had been called by the owner. He had come back and talked to the owner and said, "Let me know when he's coming back." He came back, he paid for it, and helped our guy put it in his truck and help it deliver. He's since made two additional deliveries to the church wow. of food because he is watching for food that can be donated. So he's not a part of our group, but he is excited and helping. The very next Thursday night we meet every week on Thursday evenings. Mm-hmm. A guy walks in from a local business, from a local dance studio, and offers us a $650 dance package to auction off for a fundraiser.
Wow.
The pizza place right next to his dance studio has offered to provide food at cost for any event that we might have, and also host some spirit nights to give proceeds. I mean, it's just one thing after another. We have two women who are now attending, who read about our potential community garden. Not even our community garden, but what we might do in the future, and have started becoming regular tenders of the table because they're excited about what we're doing and want to be a part. So we went from that 1 year plateau with maybe an average of 12 people attending. Sometimes we canceled because we didn't have enough people, to now 22 people within 3 weeks and continuing to add folks. And it's just, I mean, we can't deny that, you know, when you ask God, what are you doing and how do we be a part of it? Be careful of what might come.
That's exciting stuff for sure. If you were asked to describe our current paradigm of mission in the life, not just in the life of Community of Christ, but as we look out to the greater religious community and maybe even beyond the USA globally, how would you describe that?
In my experience, I mean, and I think the paradigm that I sense that we're in, first of all, now that, which I look back and say, well, the encounter with God was kind of a result of doing mission, it is now at the forefront. It is the starting factor. Like I said, we began to pray, God, what are you doing? And so that encounter with God is central. Another piece is that relationship that, you know, we don't, at the table, we don't care where people come from or what their lifestyle is or whatever. The fact that they want to be a part of sacred community is what matters most to us. And that forms and informs our mission. So relationship, but also realizing that mission is not only those mission trips around the world, but it is that family across the street. So it's local and it's global. Because of where our world is and our understanding of the global context, we realize how close at hand it is and how deeply connected we are to those globes. So it's not just those folks over in that third world country, developing nation, that need our help, but they are part of our humanity. We hear from the Doctrine and Covenants, in their welfare resides your welfare. It's becoming every day more and more true as we become more globalized. And there are people who, of course, who want to fight that because it's much easier when you just stay in your own little world. But mm-hmm. I think that is in our paradigm, we're kind of like my journey. We can't not ask these questions. Our paradigm of mission requires that we ask and answer or seek answers for those questions. And so the encounter with God, asking God what God is doing, and then being a part of it, rather than saying, here's something that we're willing to do and hopefully God will bless it. I can't say enough about the belonging before the believing. Mm. You know, I worked in the restaurant business before coming into ministry. I was in the restaurant business for 12 and a half years. I was a manager. I have likened our mission outreach to that journey for me. So in the restaurant business, as a manager, our responsibility was to create a profit. And in order to do that, we had to manage three things. We had to manage our personnel, mm-hmm. our labor costs. Mm-hmm. We had to manage our food costs. And we had to we were a full-service restaurant, so we had to manage our liquor costs. There are a couple of ways. There are probably many ways that you could do that. But for this analogy, there are two essential ways. One is you can cut the number of people you have on the floor, have cooks double up on their work and the servers cover a few more tables and that kind of thing. And you can cut the portion size of your food and put a little less alcohol in the drinks, water them down a little bit. And, you know, so then you charge your money, you will make more profit, right? Or the other side is you can have extra servers on. You can put a little extra food on the plate or at least have a size of portion that feels like a value. Mm-hmm. And you can make drinks that people enjoy, and you can create an environment of relationship that make people want to come and be a part. If you do the first, where you cut your staff and you cut your food portions and you cut your this and your that, eventually you'll only need that many staff members, and you could probably cut a little bit more, and because people will not be coming back. You know, they're going to go where they can get value and being taken care of and feel mm-hmm. welcome. if you take care on the front end of those coming in the door, they're going to want to be a part of that, and they're going to come, they're going to return. The restaurant that I was in, I was 20 years out of the business, still in contact with some of the people who had been regulars in the restaurant because of the relationships that we built. In the church, we can set rules and boundaries and cut and have all these things that people have to do to belong and to believe, and we're just talking. You know, we can talk about mission and write a check and send it overseas. What is happening at the table is we're putting it to life. I mean, it's real, and so we're engaging in the relationships, we're engaging in the action, we're putting motion and action to our words, and people want to be a part of that, and they're filling the church. So if we start with, and I remember my right after I was ordained, there was a heavy push. We've got to fill the pews. Mm. Look at all these empty pews. We've got to fill the pews, fill the pews, fill the pews. And that didn't sit well with me. Something didn't feel right about that. I mean, aren't we supposed to bring people into relationship with God and with Christ? And, I always felt like, again, if we fill the plates, if we have the right number of servers, if we're doing the right things, the pews will fill because people will be excited and want to be a part. When that is our goal, then we cut portions and we cut this and we cut that and this is the focus. But we don't have the long-lasting relationship that connects and brings people back. I've never questioned whether or not the community of Christ has a message that could just absolutely explode, a way of being, and certainly under our current paradigm of mission, that could blow the roof off our churches. And some would say that'd be a great thing if we didn't have, the buildings. But I don't think numbers and all that would be an issue if we really lived. I mean, and the table for me is a prime example. I mean, Highland congregation, lovely, wonderful people, and our existing congregations are an incredible gift and resource to us. But there's a new life in Highland because we were willing to experiment with a new expression of the church, to see church as more than what happens on Sunday morning, but kind of an everyday way of life and being with people. Now those people are coming in and changing the culture of the congregation and exciting them in a way that the pastor or myself could never have done by preaching a sermon on Sunday morning.
I'm hearing you really connect some of the things you said earlier too about the heart of being is actions of love, choosing a path of love, and this keen awareness of belonging first, creating community, trusting relationships, listening to story, and together in that newly created community of people that can be together in a building or outside the church building, that's no longer a designation of where church happens. We can certainly take advantage of that space as you are with the pantry and use it as a tool for mission. But what I'm hearing you do is just exploring and listening to what God is already doing and responding to that in ways that are liberating people to just do these really exciting things.
Yeah, so one of the things that's a conversation that's happening behind the scenes, and I hesitate to make this public because if the wrong person hears it, they could go into panic mode. But we had a local facility donate 7 dining room tables and 40 chairs. And so somebody said, what if we took out the pews and put tables in our sanctuary and created this environment every day? And it was like, could we do that? Well, yeah, we could. I mean, we've got to be careful because there are people who like the traditional. And it's not just old folks. I've run into young adults who love the center aisle of the church and, that kind of thing. So it's being sensitive to that, but also giving permission to just say, God, what can we do? If tables will be the thing that makes somebody feel comfortable to come in and be a part of our sacred community, then I think God would be okay with that.
I love your deep understanding of hospitality, which really has threaded through other career paths that you've participated in, like the restaurant business, your ministry, and your everyday life, having been a guest in your home. That is definitely core. Well, Blake, are there some things about mission today that really excite you? And the other question I have is, how do you see mission emerging now and into the future in the life of the church? Understanding none of us have a crystal ball, but are you seeing things unfolding or hints of things unfolding?
I think what excites me about mission and where we are in the church right now is just from top to bottom, in terms of the hierarchy or the administrative structure of the church, this willingness to experiment, this willingness to just say, okay, we don't have to do this because this is the way we've always done it. And understand, and you and I have had conversations before, that there are things about tradition that are just so important and that we enjoy and we connect with and I would hate to see gotten rid of. But at the same time, it's not this adamant, you got to only follow this way, but really being open to God. That excites me, because 10 years ago, we would have never attempted something like the table in where I have been without fear of, oh, you're being heretics. we certainly would never have considered moving the pews in any of the places that I've been, moving the tables, maybe Graceland. So at Graceland, we were pretty non-traditional at times, but in most of our congregations, to suggest that we would even consider taking the pews out for tables or otherwise. I mean, in some places, even putting in chairs is over the top. But so that excitement and this, what I feel is a movement to really, again, putting action to our words and becoming the hands and feet of Christ in the world. There are a couple of songs that have really become, in a way, a mantra for me. So in 2014 at the International Youth Forum that we had, which is the gathering of youth from around the church, sponsored in Independence, I was a part of the worship team for that. And one of the things that came out of our worship, one of the songs that we chose to sing in the beginning was a song by Matthew West called Do Something. Mm. And it resonated so strongly with the people that were gathered, young and old, that we began to put it into every service. And in our closing service, it was just this rallying song. And it's based on this idea. Matthew, as he wrote the song, is saying, you know, I wake up in the morning and I see all this injustice and I shake my fist at God and I say, why don't you do something? And God says, I did. I created you. Mm. And that is just, I mean, that's a wake-up call, if you will. The other song is by a guy named Josh Wilson, and it's called I Refuse. Mm. And it just, his words, he says, this world needs God, but it's easier to stand and watch. I could say a prayer and just move on like nothing's wrong, but I refuse. Because I don't want to live like I don't care. I don't want to say another empty prayer. I refuse to sit around and wait for someone else to do what God has called me to do. Oh, I could choose not to move, but I refuse. And those songs just have continued to resonate for over these last 4 to 5 years. And that's where I see people getting excited and connected. So emerging and moving into the future, just a continued willingness, I think, to listen to God and not to long for days past and ways past, because those were culturally appropriate and time appropriate, given circumstances in the world, a less global community. But we're in a different world. We have to give ourselves permission to say that wasn't God's only way. I mean, we have always been a church that has said God is not done with us. God is still speaking. And yet we live sometimes in, well, okay, yeah, God did speak to us for a little while longer, but now we have the truth. And opening to say, if we really believe in ongoing revelation, if we really believe that God is alive, then let God be alive you know, and that's going to mean some different things that might be a little uncomfortable and might cause us to do some things that we would have never thought possible. And I understand. I mean, this table thing has kind of become consuming.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I get calls from members of this group every day asking, can we do this? Have we done this? Are we doing this? And so part of that staying in the old paradigm is I don't have to be any busier than I already am. But if I'm going to be a part of what God's doing, hold on, because it could be crazy if we're really connecting. So,
yeah, I love hearing these stories. Blake, you have had a lot of experience in the life of the church all over the place and across the USA. I want to know if you have some tips you might share with us, and tips that might help people that are having this bubbling sense of they can do something.
It will just repeat some of the things that I've said, but to just put it in a list of tips, I mean, first and foremost, start with God. Again, we do believe that God is still active and alive, and it's so important to see what God is already doing. It's not we have a mission and we need God to approve it. God has a mission and is looking for someone to live it out. And so if we start with God, that's important. Second, I would say love first. Mm-hmm. Love first. I mean, if I've learned anything over the 25 years, that relationships are more important than any issue, lifestyle, otherwise. I mean, obviously there are some things that are harmful and those are not acceptable, but in general, living day to day, we just need to love first. That's what we get from God. We don't always deserve it, but we get it in spite of ourselves, and so we need to offer that. Third, I would say don't assume that you have all the answers.
Mm-hmm.
We're not the fixers. We're companions on the journey, as our hymn says. And so to go and listen to the stories and hear how God is working in ways in the lives of those persons, just opening the doors, the fact that they're coming to the table, and I don't mean in this case our ministry, but coming, there's a place at the table for everyone. You know, one of the things that I think has happened and happens from time to time is that the table is kind of this fixed entity. It's maybe, say, it's a 5-foot diameter table. You can only put so many people around the table. And so for someone to sit at the table, someone else has to get up and leave. And that is a paradigm that is something that happened for so long. If there really is a place for everyone at the table, we need to increase the size of the table and let everybody be at the table, regardless of where they are on the
mm-hmm,
spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, not assuming that we have all the answers, but listening. And I some of my closest confidants and friends are people who think absolutely diametrically opposed to what I believe theologically, but the relationship is critical, and I wouldn't trade it for the world. Pray, listen, and watch. Pray, listen, and watch, because as a 70, and my spiritual director used to tell me this. I mean, I'm such a 70. I just want, oh, here's an idea. Oh, let's go do it, without taking the time to step back and say, okay, God, you know what are you doing? How do I be a part? I mean, I know that's repetitive, but I mean, just praying and listening to the stories of others, watching the interactions of relationships of others, seeing how people respond to one another and asking the question why. I mean, we look at somebody and we make a decision about who they are or what they believe or what they think or how they're going to be. But if we watch, sometimes there may be something in their past story that has brought them to that place. And you know, I can tell you story after story of people that I've sat down to talk to and listen to who just needed to be heard.
Mm-hmm.
People who were angry and just on the edge, that you would have thought, I don't want to have anything to do with them. They don't have a place here. But once they were heard, they softened, their hearts softened. They might not change their ideas or their views completely, certainly not all at once, but they have a place at the table. So very mm-hmm. important. I think finally I would just say, don't wait. Don't wait. I mean, we sit in our pews and we wait for God to move, you know? Let's approach God and be intentional about this, because God's going to move with or without us.
Those are great tips. Thank you so much. Well, it's about the end of our time, but I want to ask you one more question, and that is, Blake, is there anything that you wanted to say or share that I didn't ask you about or give you opportunity to do?
No, I probably took the liberty to cover, you know, everything. I think it's been covered. So thanks so much for the opportunity.
We are so happy to have you with us, Blake. If you're okay with it, in our credits, et cetera, posting of this Project Zion podcast online, are you okay if we use your email so people can reach out to you if they have any questions?
That would be great.
Wouldn't that be great?
That would be great. And I would only say that if I don't respond within 24 hours, I try to tell my folks this, you know, I will respond. I think I have a pretty good reputation of responding, but it may take 24 hours. If it's more than that, send me another one and remind me. But I try to pay pretty close attention.
Thank you so much. That would be great. Well, listeners, thank you for being with us today here on Project Zion Podcast in our What's Brewing series that's all about mission. This is your host, Robin Linkhart, saying goodbye. Go out and make the world a better place. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to Project Zion Podcast. Subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcast, Stitcher, or whatever podcast streaming service you use. And while you are there, give us a 5-star rating. Project Zion Podcast is sponsored by Latter-day Seeker Ministries of Community of Christ. The views and opinions expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Latter-day Seeker Ministries or Community of Christ. The music has been graciously provided by Dave Hines.